You're saying somebody has proof the Earth is more than 6 billion years old.
He saw it when he was at the Grand Canyon.
Oh, he saw it at the Grand Canyon.
Uh-huh.
Okay. What you see at Grand Canyon is a bunch of layers of rock. They don't have dates on them. Let me give you something that you could give this person that would help them. On my videotape number 4 of my series, I'll call up the picture. Are the pictures on screen there? Okay. I go through how this geologic column was developed in 1830 by Charles Lyell and some other guys. The geologic column does not exist any place in the world except in the textbooks and in the imagination of those who believe in it. There is no geologic column. Let's see. What you'd want to show him, on video number 4, I talk all about the Grand Canyon, et cetera, and the geologic column. Some things that'll help him, and this is all on, like I said, tape. My blue series of tapes is my seminar that I cover here, how it's based on circular reasoning. These pictures, though, will probably will help him. All over the world, they find petrified trees standing straight up, running through many layers of rock. Petrified trees in the vertical position, running through multiple rock layers, indicate the rock layers are not different ages. They cannot be. All those rock layers were laid down during one big flood in the days of Noah. They're called polystrata fossils. They find them, literally thousands of them, all over the world. Now, the evolutionist has two very embarrassing choices to make with these polystrata trees. And not just trees, sometimes it's other animals too. Sometimes the trees are upside down, running through many rock layers. They can either say the trees stood there for millions of years while the rock formed around them, or they grew through hundreds of feet of solid rock looking for sunlight. There's a third choice. They were all buried in a big flood. And that's what happened. So if he thinks Grand Canyon proves the Earth is millions of years old, he's mistaken for numerous reasons. Number one, the top of Grand Canyon is higher than the bottom by about 4,000 feet. This one, I had a professor at a university here a few months ago tell me the same thing. Let's see, right here. Over millions of years, the Colorado River carved the Grand Canyon from solid rock. This is what the textbooks teach, okay? And if you go there to take a tour of it, then they'll show you the rocks and say this one is, you know, so many million years old, etc. Well, if you built a dam across Grand Canyon, a huge lake would form behind it. It'd be a big dam, too, by the way, but it'd be a huge lake formed behind there. The top of Grand Canyon is 6,000-foot elevation. The river enters the canyon at 2,800 feet elevation and goes downhill from there. Rivers all flow downhill, right? Well, the top of Grand Canyon is higher than the bottom. The river runs through the bottom, not the top. The top is higher than where the river enters the canyon, which means that river could not form that canyon. The rivers don't flow uphill. There is no delta. Where's the mud that washed out from all that stuff from Grand Canyon? It was going so fast, it went clear to the Pacific Ocean. There's no delta at the end of Grand Canyon. That was not formed by the Colorado River. I cover a whole lot more on that on video number 6 of my series. Okay? And again, none of my stuff's copyrighted. We tell folks, if you can't afford the tapes, buy one, copy it, send it back, and swap it out for number 2, then copy that one, send it back, and swap it out for number 3. Honestly. And when you're done, send the last one back and get your money back. Now, I used to loan my tapes out. I'm a Baptist, and I learned right away, Baptists do not steal, but they do borrow and never return. So I gave up on this loaning stuff idea. I said, well, sell it, and you can buy it back off you when you're done. Okay, it'll help if you ask the questions in the same order that I have the answers. That would really help. Okay? Yes, sir.
Have you ever found any frozen or petrified trees, and if which would be from before the flood? And have they sectioned them to see if there are any rings in there?
Good question. Frozen trees are found all the time. I was in Alaska a few weeks ago speaking at Jerry Prevost Church, and I was up there taking the little cruise out to see one of the glaciers, and I met a guy who worked at the North Slope, and they did drilling for oil. He said, you know, all the time they would drill down about 1,000 feet through frozen mud, and then they would drill through a forest buried 1,000 feet underground. He said, the other day we were drilling, and the guys kept bringing in these core samples. We drilled down 300 feet straight through the top of a tree. First place, there aren't many 300-foot-tall trees in the world. There are none in Alaska, 300 feet tall. And here they were drilling right through a 300 feet of solid wood to get down to get to the oil down beneath. I cover how the trees were buried and how the oil formed and all that stuff on video number 6 about the Hovind theory on the Ice Age and how that all fit together. I call it the Hovind theory for lack of a better name. But yes, frozen trees are found. As far as rings, there is some controversy about that. Oh. Brother, that bug made it right in there. Some of the trees. That's pretty good. Some of the trees do have rings. Some do not. The wood that they found from Noah's Ark, if they found Noah's Ark down in the valley, the Dunipar site or whatever they call it, does not have rings on it. In the wood. So apparently there weren't any seasons before the flood. But some of the stuff they find in the North Slope of Alaska did have rings. Okay. Yes, sir.
Question, why was man created?
Why was man created? Boy, I wish I had an answer to that one. Apparently, God wanted to have fellowship with us, and he gave us a free will. He could have made robots, you know, but then it wouldn't mean anything. So I think God wants us to love him. I tell people, you know, I'm 6'1", my wife is 5'0". I can come home and grab her by the throat and say, you tell me you love me. Well, she'd tell me, but it wouldn't mean anything. It's a whole lot better when I come home. Hi, dear. Hi, dear. And God could make us love him, but he didn't do that. He gave us a free choice, so I suspect it's because he wants our fellowship.
I heard a rumor.
Okay.
About someone, either you or your staff, are offering money to someone that can come up with evidence for evolution, infallible evidence. Is that true?
Yes, sir. $250,000 for evidence for evolution. I don't have the $250,000, but a friend of mine in Oregon does. He's loaded. Here's the offer right here. Okay? Real empirical evidence for evolution. We'll give $250,000. Tell them.
How long have you been doing that?
We started off with 10,000 about 10 years ago, and now it's $250,000 just for about a year. There's no evidence for evolution. I tell them, put up or shut up.
Yeah, I just have a couple of questions.
Okay.
One is, if you could give again that the dates for the debate with Hugh Ross, would be great to listen to.
Okay,
that.
John Ankerberg is in Chattanooga, Tennessee. He's got a TV program, and we're going to do the debate at his place in Chattanooga. I think it's not going to be till June. The one we did on radio, it's only 30 minutes. It just wasn't long enough. We've got a book out there on the table, and also it's offered in my catalog. It's showing all the things that Hugh Ross teaches that are just flat wrong. The book is called Creation and Time. When I had the debate with Hugh Ross on the radio just for 30 minutes, I said, Hugh, now you teach it was a local flood in the days of Noah. He said, no, it was a universal flood. It only killed Noah's universe. It didn't flood the whole world. That's what he teaches. Well, I got a real problem with that. First place, the Bible says the water was above the mountains. Now, if the water's above the mountains, it's no longer a local flood. Secondly, why on earth would God tell Noah to build a big boat and stay in there for a year with a bunch of animals? Tell him to move. Okay? That's just one of many things that he teaches that are wrong.
Just the last one was the redshift. You hear so much about the redshift.
Okay.
And if you could just cover just briefly what that is and how you see that.
Okay. I shouldn't have done that. Hit the wrong button. I cover, my question answer tape is tape number 7 of my series, of the Blue Series out there, and it's got a long answer to redshift, Cepheid variables, carbon dating, all that kind of stuff. That's going to have to boot up the whole thing now. 300, there it is. Okay. Okay. How do we see stars that are billions of light years away? Redshift. So let me give, this answer will take just a minute, so hang on a second. We see lots of stars in the universe. No question, there's gazillions of them. Bible says God made the stars to be for signs and seasons. Stars are so far away, all you see is a point of light. You get the biggest telescope, look at the closest star, you don't see a thing except a dot. All you see is a dot. Estimates are there are enough stars out there right now that everybody on Earth could have 2 trillion of them to himself. That'll be fun in heaven, just traveling around, won't it? The way you calculate the distance to a star is with what's called parallax trigonometry. Now, if you want to calculate a distance to a point you can't get to, like across a canyon, you have to have 2 observation points and know the distance between them and calculate the angles. This is limited, though. Earth's diameter is 8,000 miles, which is nothing compared to star distance. So what they've done to enlarge the base of the triangle is look at the star in January, look at it again in June, and make a big triangle out of Earth's orbit around the sun as your base. Well, Earth's orbit around the sun, even though it's a huge circle, 93 million mile radius, it's only 8 light minutes. That's the radius, which is 16 light minute diameter. So without getting everybody bored to tears on this, basically Earth's orbit around the sun has a diameter of 8 light minutes. Now, 1 year has 525,000 minutes. So if you're going to look at a star from opposite sides of Earth's orbit, if you're going to measure something 1 light year away, you got a real skinny triangle. That's like having two surveyors set up their transit 16 inches apart and look at a dot 8 1/4 miles away. That's a pretty skinny triangle. That's for 1 light year. Now, if you want to measure 100 light years, you got to move your dot 826 miles away. And that, of course, is assuming you can tell exactly where you were 6 months ago. The point is, you simply can't measure the distance to stars beyond a few light years. This textbook says you can measure 100 light years. Okay, I doubt it, but I'll give them 100. You can't measure billions, okay, that's for sure. Things to consider about starlight. Number one, we cannot measure the distance, period. Number two, we don't know what light is. We certainly don't know that it always travels the same speed. Matter of fact, we know it does not always travel the same speed. A physicist in Denmark earlier this year slowed light down to 38 miles an hour in his laboratory. And the way they measure the speed of light now is with the atomic clock, which uses the wavelength of a cesium-133 atom, which means they're actually using the wavelength of light to measure the speed of light. Well, now think about it, okay? If light is slowing down, like it appears to be, then you're not ever going to see it by measuring with your atomic clock, because your clock is slowing down at the same rate the light is slowing down. The whole idea behind a black hole is that light can be attracted by gravity, and so the speed of light is not necessarily a constant. The third thing to consider, the creation was finished. It was mature. God did not make two babies in the Garden of Eden and hand them a package of seeds and say, plant these quick. You're going to need supper. Okay? He made a full-grown man, a full-grown woman, full-grown trees, and a star that you could already see the light from. So as far as the red shift and Cepheid variables, what's causing the red shift, nobody knows what's causing it. It could be the Doppler effect of light. We can go into all that for a long time if you'd like. But the Bible says God stretched out the heavens. That verse appears several times. He stretched out the heavens. Most of the experts will say red shifts do not indicate distances. They used to think so in the early days, but they don't. Okay, they get all sorts of distances, all sorts of numbers based on the red shift. They do not know what's causing the red shift or the distance to the stars based on the red shift. And we can go 2 more hours just on that. I don't want to bore everybody, but they measure the brightness of a star to determine the distance. Well, it's pretty bright. That one's not as bright. That must be farther away. Now, hold on just a minute. You have to be careful about these brightness. You know, they call it luminosity measurements because they have huge systematic errors, and it could be that it's absorbing matter in space. You're looking through dust clouds or something. We don't know. Okay, it could be from faintness or absorbing matter in space. So there isn't anybody who can tell you the Earth is... the universe is billions of years old because of the starlight question. Okay, that's normally one of the ones that comes up, and that's first on tape number 7. Yes, sir.
I got 2 quick ones.
Okay.
First of all, I you know, I'm real familiar with, you know, the creation side and where to find research and all that. As far as on the evolution side, as far as what they consider credible, what are some good resources to tap into for current research and how they're seeing things? It seems like they're always changing their mind on things. And,
wait a minute, slow down. So summarize that question in a few words. It was, what are some good resources for?
Research, or just up-to-date information as far as on their side.
On their side?
Instead of hearing it from our side, to hear what they're saying about what they believe.
Oh, the evolutionists write prolifically. I mean, there's stuff in science journals all the time. Scientific American is one of their big ones, Nature magazine, National Geographic. They publish in all sorts of magazines. As far as the refutation of that from the creation side, they won't ever put it in. There are several good creation organizations. Of course, ICR down here in San Diego is tremendous. You know, Henry Morris, a good friend of mine, and Dwayne Gish are doing awesome work, you know, on Answers in Genesis with Ken Ham. Walt Brown in Phoenix, Arizona, creationscience.org, creationscience.com. He's got a great resource. Oh, hang on. I got to plug my computer in. It's flashing at me here. There. It's a real battle, okay, between the two, and you can read plenty on either side. I would say I read lots of books by the evolutionists, and I'm certainly willing to answer any questions I have or debate them anytime, you know.
The other question is, a friend of mine who's currently in college basically told me that you can't go on just observable information and repeatable experiments because she said mathematics has been able to prove in law or something like that. I mean, is there anything in the mathematical field that is substantial that the evolutionists can use as far as, I mean, because they seem to blow all the other rules of science?
I don't know of anything from mathematics that supports evolution.
Okay.
Just the mathematics itself, the way there's so many things about mathematics that indicate a designer. For instance, who's the Avogadro's principle? Is that the one where the two numbers, the sum of the preceding numbers equals the next number, like 1 plus 2 is 3, and then 2 plus 3 is 5. So there's a sequence. It goes 1, 2, 3, 5, 8, 13. That same sequence is found on the bottom of pine cones. When you look at the bottom of a pine cone, there'll be 8 one way and 13 the other way if you count the dots.
Fibonacci
principle, that Fibonacci numbers, yeah. It's found all over nature. It's found in seashells when they, the ram's horn, the curl of the ram's horn. Fibonacci numbers, that's it. Thank you, sir. How'd we get off on that?
I can't. Can you comment a little bit about the so-called transitional form, particularly Lucy and Neanderthal man?
Sure. Okay. I cover Lucy. Matter of fact, I'll probably get into a little bit of that tomorrow night. The so-called cavemen. I may not get quite that far. That's on seminar tape number 2 out there of the series. Cavemen. It'll take a second to boot up here. What's happened, when Darwin's book came out in 1859, he predicted we would find evidence for missing links between the different kinds. They decided the closest animal that looks the closest to man would be the apes, and so we would have come from an ape-like ancestor. Let's see. Seminar 2, the second half of the tape, has this stuff on the cavemen, which is what it's about. Textbooks teach, you know, this is Grandpa. Nebraska man was actually found, all they found was one tooth. That was it. They built the man and his wife from one tooth. They later found out the tooth came from a pig. There's the real Nebraska man. Piltdown man was a deliberate fraud. Human skull, ape's jawbone. Fooled the experts for 40 years. It was in the textbooks as proof for evolution. Neanderthal man is still in the textbooks, but it's just an old man with arthritis is all it was. Lucy is the one that's in there now. Australopithecus afarensis. Donald Johanson found Lucy in 1974. He named it Lucy because they were listening to the Beatles song Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds, which has the initials LSD on purpose. He said Lucy's knee joint, the femur, the thigh bone, was angled, proving she's becoming a human. Actually, the one that they called Lucy in National Geographic, that knee was found 1.5 miles away from the skeleton, 200 feet deeper in the strata. Lucy did have a knee, of course, but it wasn't the one they listed in National Geographic. Now, Tom Willis has a bunch of good stuff on that. He said, because the femur is angled, that proves it's becoming a human. Well, first place, any monkey that climbs trees has an angled femur. So it doesn't prove it's becoming a human. It's a tree climbing, or called an abhorral monkey. He said Lucy's knee was slightly bigger than a regular ape. Well, that's true. But that doesn't prove it's becoming a human. The bones of a Clydesdale are slightly bigger than a regular horse. It is not becoming a truck because of that. St. Louis Zoo put human feet on their Lucy display. They have a wax figure there, supposed to be Lucy, with human feet on it. The statue is a complete misrepresentation. That's a big word for fraud, lie. The zoo officials, they said, have no plans to knuckle under. We cannot be updating every exhibit based on every new piece of evidence. We look at the overall exhibit and the impression it creates. We think the overall impression is correct. What impression are they trying to get across? They're trying to teach the kids that Lucy's a missing link, and it's not. Lucy's just a human, just an ape is all it was. It was 3 feet tall. And the experts know that. Charles Oxnard spent 16 years studying every bone in Lucy, measured all the dimensions, graphed it out on a computer, and said, folks, Lucy is just a monkey. That's it. There might be some of those creatures that walk upright, like Lucy, still alive right now today. The best book I know of on the topic is this one by Marvin Lubinow called Bones of Contention. If you want to get more on Lucy, we've got that on the table out there, I think. Tremendous book on all of the so-called cavemen. There simply aren't any. We were made in God's image, and God's not a monkey. Okay? Yes?
Forgive me if there's an obvious answer to this, but at the end you had said that the cure for cancer, heart attacks, and all that stuff is okay. In Genesis.
Yes,
what did you mean by that, that the cure is in Genesis?
We're going to cover that tomorrow night.
Okay.
What the Bible teaches. See, what the original creation was like. If you read Genesis 1, verse 29 and 30, God told them to eat the fruit, vegetables, and seeds. Seeds to fruit contain a vitamin called vitamin B17. And people that get lots of B17 in their diet never get cancer. Wild animals never get it because they eat, you know, wild fruits, wild vegetables. Dogs and cats go outside, and when they get sick, and they eat grass. Certain grasses contains vitamin B17. It's called Nutrilicides. There's a long story behind it. But if there's a book out there on the table called The World Without Cancer, tremendous book. The first half of the book deals with how cancer works biologically. The second half of the book deals with the politics of why the cure has been suppressed. Money. I'd recommend you get that one. It's a great book. Okay.
Sorry, can I ask a really quick one? I know you have a lot of stuff out there. What would be, if we can get one thing, what would be the best?
If you can only get one thing. If you had four flat tires on your car, which one?
Do the whole returning thing, right?
You can return everything. I recommend you start with my blue series of tapes, the seminar. Tape number one, which is what I covered tonight and this morning. Actually, there's a lot more on that tape because it's 2.5 hours long. And then there's seven tapes, 15 hours altogether, and it'll answer just about every question I've ever heard come up. And you're welcome to. If somebody else gets them, and you can copy anybody. Honestly, seriously, they're not copyrighted.
Okay.
I'd rather have you have the information.
Thank you.
Okay? Yes, sir.
First of all, I praise God for your ministry.
Oh, thank you, sir.
And thank you very much for coming here, and please keep up the good work.
Oh, thank you.
Clearly, the evidence is overwhelming to support the Bible and to refute evolution. And I started reading Henry Moore's stuff back 20 years ago.
It's awesome.
And it frustrates me that the scientific community still has the aura that evidence is behind them when it's not. So science and education, which purport to seek the truth and to look at the facts, are suffering from the Romans 1 syndrome and, you know, thinking themselves to be wise, they've become as fools.
Exactly right.
What can we as individual Christians do to get the word out and to get the facts on the table so that they have to...
Good question. What can we do? Okay, in my seminar notebook, I have a section at the end of the white pages called the battle plan. What can we do? Some practical steps. I think it's interesting to note in the Bible, Jesus made no attempt to change the Roman Empire. He changed one person at a time. I think the best approach is for us individually to reach people one at a time and forget what's going on. Just reach everybody in your little community. Reach your Jerusalem, and then your, you know, Judea, and then Samaria, and then the uttermost parts of the earth. So, I have found the most effective thing is video. Like I said this morning, people will sit home and watch a video that you will never get to come to church. But you can give them a videotape for Christmas, and they'll sit home and get saved. One guy called me a few months ago. He said, Brother Hovind, somebody gave me your tape. I watched 10 minutes, and I got so angry, I shut it off and stormed out of the room. He said, I was fuming for 30 minutes. Finally, I calmed down. I came back in, flipped it back on, watched about 20 more minutes, and got angry and shut it off and stormed out of the room. Calmed down, came back in, turned it on, watched the rest of the tape, and got saved.
Okay. How do you answer the evolutionists when they say that the moon hasn't moved the same rate always? It's moved at
good
slower
question.
Rates and things
has
like that.
The moon is moving, okay,
right.
But has it always moved at the same rate? We don't know that. I turn back and I say, that's a good question. Now, do you know that is the same true of carbon dating? How do you know the rate's always been the same? Or potassium, argon, or anything else? All we know is the moon is leaving us. Okay, that's been observed. Now, if you want to imagine something other than that, you're welcome to, but that's not what's really science. See, science is what we know based on observation or testing or demonstrations, and all we know is it's moving. So the evolutionist is begging several questions. They're not answering, where did the moon come from? Where did it get its energy to begin with? Why does it have enough energy to go around? you know? And how did it originate? You know, it is moving away. So, correct. We don't know if the rate, it's without getting real complicated, if it's a linear progression back into time or logarithmic progression. Probably logarithmic, but we don't know. The fact is, regardless, it still puts a time limit, some kind of time limit. Yes, sir.
You indicated that the oldest tree discovered was some 4,300 years old. How was that age determined?
Okay, the age of the oldest tree, it's called the bristlecone pine. It's called the Methuselah tree in some place in Southern California. I'm not sure how far it is from here. But they actually drill a hole into the tree and pull out a core sample and count the rings. The problem with tree ring dating is it is not real accurate because trees can often produce two rings in 1 year. I have a friend of mine who told me that just a few weeks ago at a meeting, he said, Brother Hovind, I make walking sticks for people, canes, for a living. That's what I do. He said, I raise the, I think it's a yew bush or something he raises. He said, I raise them for 7 years, cut them down, and they always have 11 rings. They're 7 years old. He said, you grow them for 7 years, they got 11 rings when you cut them down. So trees do not always produce one ring a year, but they drill a real tiny hole in and pull out a core sample and count it. The Methuselah tree, though, grows, by the time it's 100 years old, it's 1 inch in diameter. It takes 100 years to get an inch around. Very slow-growing tree. And so they count the rings with a microscope. And there are times when they miss you know, bad season, they don't get a growth ring at all. They may get two rings in a year, depending on rain, and there's too many factors involved. But roughly 4,300 years, that's what the experts agreed on. Okay, yes, ma'am.
I don't know if I'm taking one of your pictures too literally, but on the one with the scale with the old Earth theory and the new Earth theory, you did have like this little pile on the old Earth. Is there any evidence for the old Earth theory?
Okay. The evidence they use for the old Earth theory is two things. Number one, they use majority opinion. Everybody believes it's old, so therefore it must be old. Secondly, they'll use things like carbon dating, potassium-argon dating, rubidium-strontium dating, any of those. And I cover carbon dating in great detail on video number 7, question-answer. If you want, I can go through carbon dating. Is that a question somebody has?
So there's no solid evidence that the old Earth theorists have that are maybe just minuscule that the young Earth theorists can argue against? Or is it that the young Earth theories are just so overwhelming that you can just overlook those little minuscule facts that may be true?
Okay, I have not seen anything that is not capable of being refuted, you know, which is why we offer the $250,000 for evidence for evolution and why I'm willing to debate any 5 evolutionists at a time, you know, 5-on-1. The guys are a lot smarter than I am, but I win every time because I'm right and they're wrong. I got a lot of my debates on videotape out there. It's the Red Series of tapes. Those are all debates. They're a lot of fun. Yes, sir.
Yes, one of the ICR hierarchy mentioned about Ernst Haeckel.
Ernst Haeckel, yep.
Something like, you know, how you get from a fish to a frog to a dog, that kind of thing. Where did he get his information? How did he, like, how did he actually get all that stuff published in the form that it, I mean, given the fact that he published it before the, you know, the century, I guess
yes.
It was about 60s or 70s.
1869 is when Ernst Haeckel published about the embryology. You know, they call it ontogeny recapitulates phylogeny was the fancy phrase. What it means is, as the baby grows inside the mother, it goes through the stages of evolution. Fish, amphibian, reptile, mammal. Just memorize the word farm, F-A-R-M. Fish, amphibian, reptile, mammal. That's the way they say it happened. Here's the story behind it. At the end of videotape number 4, let's see, right here. This is from a typical textbook showing how that one of the evidences for evolution is from development. This textbook says, the similarity between the early stages in the development of many different animals helped convince Darwin that all forms of life shared common ancestors. They show the wrinkles of skin under the chin of the embryo and call them gills. They say this is gill slits. Those are not gill slits, okay? That's a lie. Ernst Haeckel made this up. Each of those little folds of skin develops into bones in the ear and glands in the throat. They never have anything to do with breathing. Never. I've seen fat folks with five or six chins, and they cannot breathe through any of them but the top one. Okay? They're not gill slits. Ernst Haeckel, the guy you're referring to, he was an embryologist in Germany who, when Darwin's book came out, he said it changed his life forever. Haeckel read Darwin's book in 1860. Darwin said, we should find evidence for my theory. 9 years later, they still had zero. Haeckel was getting kind of worried. So he said, well, I'm going to help him out a little bit. I'm going to make some evidence. He took a drawing of a human and a dog, embryo, and he changed them. He made them look just alike. There's his drawings. On top are the real drawings. Underneath are Haeckel's drawings. He lied. On top are Haeckel's drawings here. Underneath are actual photographs of these animals. Those are not anywhere close. Now, either the guy's a lousy artist or he's a liar. But he made huge charts and traveled all over Germany and held seminars like I'm doing tonight. Only his seminars were trying to convince people that evolution was true. Haeckel pretty much single-handedly converted the German public into believing in evolution. This was in 1869. And, of course, if evolution is true, then one race is superior. And the Germans, of course, thought it was them. That's where the Aryan supremacy idea comes from. And that's why Otto von Bismarck, in 1870, you know, the Franco-Prussian War, he was going to prove the Germans were superior. And later in World War I, and later again in World War II, the same theory still being taught. Haeckel's drawings were proven to be fake in 1874. He was convicted of fraud at his own university. But they're still using his drawings in textbooks today as evidence for evolution. Go check your public school. You'll find this same concept taught in any biology book right here in the Los Angeles area. They're going to tell you that humans have gill slits. This was proven wrong 125 years ago. Still in textbooks right now. They leave that in there because that's the only possible way you can scientifically justify abortion. They want to say it's not a human yet. It's just a fish or an amphibian. And if you watch my video number 4 of the Blue Series, I go through quite a bit on how abortion ties in with evolution thinking. Okay? Good. Thank you, sir. I've had these go till 11:45, preacher, so you tell me when to quit.
Oh. Hi. I think early in your presentation you mentioned that pre-flood man was contemporary with the dinosaurs.
Yes, sir.
I wonder if they missed the boat or why we don't have them now.
We do have them now. On video number 3, I go through all the story about the dinosaurs. They were just big lizards that lived with Adam and Eve. Noah took them on the ark. Probably babies, of course. Just be sure to get a pink one and a blue one. And then after the flood was over, two things happened to the dinosaurs. They died from the climate change. Remember before the flood, they lived to be 900. After the flood, that lifespan dropped off to 400 and then 200. I cover all that on why the lifespans dropped off on video number 2. We'll get into that tomorrow night. Or video number, yeah, number 2. Cover that tomorrow night. Dinosaurs were dying off from the climate change. Secondly, people were killing them. In those days, they called them dragons. And all through history, there are stories of people killing dragons. And there probably are a few still alive today. And I've got a whole hour video just on that. Video number 3, the last half of the tape, is all about dinosaurs, dinosaurs that are still living. There have been thousands of sightings in this century. There's pictures of them on my website, drdino.com. Yes, sir?
Yes. Can you explain, well, when these archaeologists find these, dinosaur bones that are digging out of the earth, the time frame that it takes for like a dinosaur bone to transform into like stone.
Okay. The time it takes for a bone to turn into a rock is somewhere between 1 and 50 years, depending on the soil it's buried in. I held in my hand a piece of petrified wood this guy gave me from Connecticut. He said, Brother Hovind, what is this? I said, it's petrified wood. He said, look at it close. I said, it's still petrified wood. He said, look at the end of it. I looked at the end, and I said, there are chop marks on there. You can see where somebody chopped it down with a hatchet. He said, yeah, I chopped it down when I was a kid. He said, our wagon tipped over or something, hit a bump or something up in the mountains of Connecticut there, and some logs bounced off, and Dad said, forget it, there was a blizzard blowing in, you know, let's go to the house. Next spring, the ground thawed, and the dirt flowed over the top of these logs, and he said, I went up and found it about 20 years later, and they had turned to stone, petrified firewood. In Iowa, some farmers had their kids, grandkids go out and pull up old fence posts. From the ground up, they were rotted. From the ground down, they were petrified.
The second question I had was, Can you explain like how the formation of like the the Caspian Sea and the Black Sea took place?
It's yes.
Both saltwater lakes, large saltwater lakes. Were they ever part of the ocean at one time?
I think on my video number 6 about the Hovind theory about how that the ice age is probably what caused the flood. And if you had a bunch of water trapped at the North and South Pole in the form of ice, the oceans would be lower. I think what happened is about 100 years after the flood, within the first 100 or so years after the flood, the ice caps were melting back and the oceans were coming up, getting deeper. Finally, they got deep enough, they spilled into the Mediterranean Sea. The Mediterranean Sea was filled later. Then when it got deep enough, it spilled into the Black Sea and the Caspian Sea. The Black Sea, Mediterranean Sea, and Caspian Sea were all filled well after the flood by the rising from the melting ice caps. Okay, watch video number 6. That'll answer a lot of those questions. Yes, sir.
I just wanted to thank you for this presentation. Thank Chuck Smith for allowing it. And I have two questions. As Americans, do we have any rights to see things changed in the public school system, to take action? And I think you already kind of answered that one. But then more specifically, I'm trying to get a job in the public school system. And this morning, I think you mentioned that a teacher can say that they don't believe in evolution?
Oh, you can read the Bible in your public school.
And I was just wondering if you could, speak a little on that.
Okay. On the end of videotape number 4, video number 4 is all about lies in the textbooks, like the, Haeckel idea we just showed you. There's a whole bunch of things they're teaching that it's not true. They're still teaching them in the textbooks, though, because they want the kids to believe in evolution. I was in a debate one time, and I mentioned about 30 things that are used as evidence for evolution that are not true, like the gill slits, like the horse having 4 toes, proven wrong 50 years ago, like the tailbone being vestigial. And I went through a whole bunch of things in this debate. The professor got up afterwards and he said, "Now, folks, Dr. Hovind is right. These things are not true. However, Dr. Hovind, I've got a question for you. What would you replace all this with?" I said, "Folks, what he's trying very hard to not say is, we want the kids to believe in evolution. We got to give them some evidence, and you're taking away our evidence, so you got to find a replacement." I said, "Sir, if you don't have any legitimate evidence for your theory, I'm sorry. Maybe you ought to get a new theory. But it's not my job to find replacements for your faulty evidence. Just get it out of the textbooks." At the end, though, I give some ideas of what to do, some practical steps of how to fix this problem. The obvious fast solution is get your kids out of the public school. Homeschool, private school, Christian school, get them out, okay? Now, if you can't do that, and some people honestly can't do that, I understand. Okay, then certainly don't send them off unarmed. Teach them. Get those kids prepared where they know the truth. I had a fellow call me a few months ago. He said, "Brother Hovind, I just got a phone call from my daughter's teacher. She's in second grade. She has watched your tapes about 50 times. Why do second graders do that? Watch the same tape over and over and over and over. Anyway, he said she has memorized all your stuff, and the teacher just got off the phone. She called me and said, "Now, sir, every time I try to teach an evolution in our classroom, your daughter stops me." The teacher said, "I've decided I'm not going to teach any more evolution this year." My first thought was, yay. And then my second thought was, why are we sending second graders off to war? Huh? Why aren't the parents fixing this problem? The kid ought to be able to go to school and read the book and believe it. So there's some real practical steps you can do. You can get on your textbook selection committee. Somebody in this county picks the books you use. Be that person. Get on the committee. And then when you get 10 books from different publishers, and they all want to sell you the book for their county, of course, for your county, of course, you go through the book, you pick out the least poisonous one, and I'll help you do that. Okay, all you got to do is call. I got a list of all the different, I collect the books. I got a bunch of stuff on them. We'll pick out the least poisonous available book. Then you do two things. You write a letter to the publishers of the other ones you didn't pick, and tell them why. "Dear CEO of HBJ, whatever, we did not pick your book this year because," and list the problems. Now, if you were the CEO from Harcourt Brace Jovanovich or Holt or, one of these textbook publishers, and you got 5,000 letters from all over the country saying, "We did not buy your book because," what are you going to do next year? Change the book. See, there's one language those guys speak. It's the universal language in textbook publishing. It's called money. Only language they speak. So you have to hit them in the pocketbook. The second thing you do, you write to the one you did pick and tell them why you picked their book. And then let them know, if we find a book next year with less evolution, we're going to pick that one. So there are some things you can do. There's a group of folks in Texas called Mel Gabler, and educational resource analysts. Tremendous material they've got. We've got his book out on the table there. It's called What Are They Teaching Our Children? It's like $4. In the back is his phone number. You can call him up and get information on what you can do in your schools. But you have incredible rights in a public school as a teacher. You can teach the Bible. You can teach them creation. You can't try to convert the kid to be a Catholic or Baptist or Buddhist or something, but you can teach them. You can discuss any theories of origins. California has a wonderful state school board policy that says very clearly discussions of any theories of origins are perfectly appropriate to the science curriculum. I go through all of that at the end of video number 4. I show the laws, what the law says, what the courts have said. Now, your individual principal may not want you to do this because he might be afraid of a lawsuit. What's happened in the last 40 years, ACLU has learned all they have to do is threaten to sue, and it'll stop. Even though they would lose the suit, it's the threat of a suit that makes people stop. So go ahead and let them sue you. The rights are on your side. You would win. Okay? Yes, ma'am.
I have a friend at my school, and I've had a chance to talk to him. I was asking him what he believed about God and stuff like that, and he told me he only believes in what he can see. So basically, whatever's there is what exists. If he can't see it, it doesn't exist. And I was trying to tell him about, wind. You can't see wind and stuff, but what would you tell him? Because he doesn't believe,
Sure. That's called naturalism. If I don't see it, or it's not, ask him, have you ever seen your brain?
I asked him, I said, you can't see emotions, right?
You can't see love, hatred, emotions, right?
And he said, if he can't see it, he doesn't think he needs it. Because he can't see God, he doesn't think he needs God. He thinks God's out there, but he doesn't really think he needs him.
I understand. Here's the flaw in his logic. I've never been to Japan, but I have a Casio databank stopwatch. Made in Japan. $50, Walmart. This is an amazing machine. It holds 150 phone numbers. It's a calculator, a stopwatch, a countdown timer. It does not tell time. You have to look at it. But it is an amazing machine. Now, is it logical for me to stand here in America and say, I believe there is a watch designer who designed this? Even though I've never seen him. Okay? Would it be illogical for me to say, I've never seen him, so he must not exist? That would be illogical, right? When you see a complex machine, you ought to come to two conclusions. There is a designer, and he's pretty smart. When you look at the world through the microscope or the telescope or just your eyeballs, you ought to come to two conclusions. There is a designer, and he's pretty smart. So it's called the teleological argument is the big name for it. But If you notice something that's designed, it's logical to say there was a designer. If you're walking along the beach and you see ripples in the sand, you would assume, nothing. If you're walking along the beach and you see John loves Mary written in the sand, you look around, you don't see anybody, would you assume the waves did that? No. I mean, design is easy to spot. I would get a bag of objects, some natural objects like a stick and a rock, and then get maybe an arrowhead and a penny. Put them in the bag and ask your friend, reach in here and pick one out and tell me if it's a naturally occurring object or if it was designed. He'll be able to pick out every one. So design demands a designer. There's just no way out of the argument. You don't have to see the designer. I never met Borglum that designed, Mount Rushmore. But I bet there was a guy. So you don't have to see him, okay? Yes, sir.
you illustrated that in, if evolution is true, then it's not immoral for you to shoot somebody.
Right.
And the Timothy Leary types would stop you and say, well, you can do whatever you want as long as you don't hurt somebody, which I recognize is illogical with the evolutionary argument, but how do you deal with that in the different debates and all that you come up with? I've always mentioned it from the consequences of sin, which might not happen for years, whether it be disease or, you know, abortion or whatever. How do you deal with that
argument? Okay. If evolution is true, then there's no difference from human life and animal life and plant life. And so a guy came to me one time, he was an environmentalist wacko, and he said, trees have rights. I said, well, sir, I believe oxygen molecules have rights. You ought to quit breathing. I mean, how far do you carry this, you know? If we're made in God's image, then human life represents, we're in the image of God, you know, and God decides when we live or die. And God already gave us a list of rules, you know. People ought to die for certain crimes. If somebody commits certain crimes, they should be executed. Not only for their good, but for the good of society, you know. It goes back to the pantheist idea that Aristotle came up with, called the Great Chain of Being, where he had man, woman, animals, plants, minerals, all in this great chain. And that's really where evolution, one of the major steps in evolution, that we're just all part of a big chain of life, and there's no difference really, quantitatively, just qualitative differences. And so if human life, if we're just evolved, then man is no different than the apes or the other trees. They do have the same equal rights. And so the Timothy Leary's who would say, I don't have the right to take his life away. Well, I would say, Timothy, do you have the right to step on an ant? If a mosquito was biting you, do you swat it? If a termite is eating your house, do you poison it? You see what I mean? You know, their logic isn't consistent. So, yeah, you got the right to swat a mosquito if he's biting you. And, you know, trap the mouse if he's eating your food in your kitchen. You got those rights. I go off on a long tangent, I think. Okay, is that enough? Yes, sir.
Two questions. The first one is, does any of your tapes have the archaeological evidence of the Exodus of Pharaoh's army going across the Red Sea?
Video number 7, which I just happen to have open right here, question answer number 7. Scoffers for years have said, if an entire army crossed the Red Sea and drowned, shouldn't we find some evidence? Well, it's a fair question, all right? I'm booting it up here. Boot is a good name for these things. Man. I know several people who've been involved in this type of study. Ron Wyatt was a good friend of mine. And let's see. Video number 7, near the end, I cover some of the stuff about the crossing of the Red Sea. Here we go. Let me get that into the slide mode. The Lord told him to go camp over against whatever the name of that city is, and camp by the sea. And it says the waters were a wall unto them. Some people try to say, well, it was just shallow water, and they went across ankle-deep water. Well, if the water is a wall on your side, okay, that's different than just going through shallow water. Secondly, it's an even bigger miracle if it's just shallow water they walked across, because Pharaoh's entire army drowned in ankle-deep water. I can see Pharaoh now. Okay, everybody lay down. Don't get up till I tell you. And the Bible says God took off their chariot wheels. This is what the Bible says. And the waters returned and covered the chariots, Exodus 14. If you look right here in Egypt, you'll see that the Red Sea comes up and splits. There's the right and left fork to the Red Sea called the Gulf of Suez and the Gulf of Aqaba. For years, everybody assumed that Mount Sinai was in the Sinai Peninsula. That's what it's named for, but nobody's ever found Mount Sinai. They thought they crossed over the left fork, which is called the Gulf of Suez, and you notice the maps have the red lines there showing the probable route of the Exodus. But they never could figure it out. Actually, they went clear across the Sinai Peninsula and crossed over the Gulf of Suez. I'm sorry, the Gulf of Aqaba. If you look at this satellite photo, right there is a white dot. I don't know if you can all see that there, but that is actually a massive beach. Pharaoh was chasing Moses and the guys, and they came running through the mountains, and they got stuck on this big beach. In front of them's the water, behind them's the mountains, and Pharaoh's army closing through the gap. At the bottom of this beach, at the south end, they found this pillar. The pillar was set up by King Solomon, and it said this was to commemorate the crossing of the Red Sea. That's the only place in the Red Sea, though it's nearly 5,000 feet deep, that's the only place where it's not real deep. It's only, I think, 900 feet deep. Right there by that beach. There's a shallow place. Of course, 900 feet, still plenty of water. But in like 8 miles across, 900 feet's not bad. It's only, I forget the slope, like 3 or 4% slope. Easy to walk across and back up. At the bottom, they found chariot wheels. And no chariots attached to them. And chariots with no wheels on them. And it's a four-spoke chariot, the same kind they used in the Egyptian 18th dynasty. So they actually, at the other side, over there in Saudi Arabia, you see the arrow pointing to Jabal al-Laws, which is on any map, which means Mountain of Laws. That's Mount Sinai. It's in Arabia. The Bible says that. Galatians 4. For this Agar is Mount Sinai in Arabia. There's a picture of it. The top is still black. The mountain burned. If you stand on Mount Sinai and look around, you'll see down below an altar with a calf carved on it. Probably where they built the altar. The Lord God said Moses, told Moses to smite the rock. First time he smote it, and God next time told him to speak to the rock, only he smote it again. And he shouldn't have. Quite a story there. That'll preach, brother. And people said, well, how can a rock give water? Most of the artist's conception will show this little trickle of water coming out. Everybody lined up with their cup, to get a drink of water. You know how long it would take to water 2 million people that way? A long time. Actually, that rock there in the center of that picture is 5 stories tall. It's got a crack right down the middle. This is right near the bottom of Mount Sinai, a few miles away from Mount Sinai. If you look at the bottom, you'll see erosion marks. Water came pouring out of that boulder. Flowed for several miles. Was there another story, Sodom and Gomorrah? If you look at the website, WyattMuseum.com, Ron Wyatt just died a few months ago, but his guy that took over, Richard Reeves, is a good friend of mine. It's just south of Nashville. W-Y-A-T-T, WyattMuseum.com. You can see all these pictures I just showed you and a lot more. Okay?
The second question, if you would comment on time is a factor of involved with gravity. Time on Earth may not be measured as the same as time at the edge of the firmament.
Einstein's theory was that time may be relative and light is a constant. Nobody knows if that's true or not. It could be that the time is the constant and light is the variable. I don't think it's affected by gravity so much. It's affected time and light, they think, may be the two. One must be a variable. That goes into the theory of relativity and is it true or not, Newtonian physics and Einsteinian physics and all that stuff. And I don't think that argument's ever been resolved. I certainly don't have an answer for it. I would say probably time is the constant. Is that enough, brother?
Thank you, Ken.
These will go. See, they'll go all day.
Yeah, I know. Okay. As I told you, I said there are two problems.
Starting and stopping.
Starting and stopping. And so we got to just step in. Now, there was one issue that was brought up as far as the moon getting further from the Earth, but we don't know that is a constant or whatever.
Right, we don't know.
How about the sun reducing in size? It would seem to me that that would be more of a constant because we do know that it's giving off energy constantly.
Right. The sun is losing about 5 million tons a second. As the sun shrinks, it's shrinking about 5 feet an hour. As it shrinks, the surface area compared to the volume, the ratio changes. A large object has more volume compared to the surface area, without getting too complicated here. But probably the sun shrinking was not a linear progression back into time. Probably it's logarithmic also. The fact is the sun is losing 5 million tons a second, which is going to greatly affect its gravitational pull. So if you want to go back in time and add 5 million tons a second, you're going to create a problem. Sucking Earth in. And so those who say it's billions of years old, I think, are just mistaken. It can't be for that reason.
How large would the sun then be?
The question is, does the sun burn by gravitational collapse or does it burn by nuclear fusion? If it's burning by fusion, it should give off neutrinos. There's been no evidence of neutrinos found. So some have argued that maybe they're being trapped in the corona. They did, in a mine in Utah, put a big tank of dry cleaning fluid down in the bottom of this mountain, because when neutrinos go through dry cleaning fluid, they produce argon gas, and they were going to test and prove the neutrino theory. After years of waiting, they found no argon gas in there, and so the experiment was a flop, so they kind of got real quiet about it. The bottom line is, we don't know how the sun burns for sure, if it's fusion or gravitational collapse. Either way, it's burning. It's losing mass. It can't be billions of years old. So I don't use the shrinking sun argument anymore as one of my main arguments for a young Earth, though I think it's still valid. The jury's still not in on some of these things about what's causing the sun to burn, which is why I don't use that one. Okay?
This is the end of Side 2 and the end of this message. If you would like further information on tapes or our free catalog, contact The Word for Today. The address is P.O. Box 8000, Costa Mesa, California, 92628. Or you may reach us by our toll-free number, 1-800-272-WORD. That's 1-800-272-WORD.